This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are there more floods? Is it climate change? Our guest is Robert M. Hirsch, a well-known research hydrologist and high-ranking water expert for the United States Geological Survey. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Robert, there is more concern about flooding, and I was surprised to find there's another whole community dealing with the year-to-year reality of floods in the United States. Most of my guests are climate scientists, but how would you characterize the differences between the climate community and maybe the civil engineers and flood planners on the ground?
Well, in the hydrologic community, civil engineers, flood planners, et cetera, we're trying to take a look at the question of flood hazards in general, which is really a combination of things that may be going on with the climate, things that are going on in the particular watersheds, and what's happening along the floodplains. And I want to just point out right off the bat that I'm not at all talking about coastal floods. Those are a very different kind of phenomena having to do with oceanic storms and sea level. I'm really talking here about river floods. And what we see is that if we look at watersheds where the effect of human activity in the watershed is relatively minimal, that is to say, no large amounts of urbanization, no dams of any substantial size, that by and large, we don't see much of a change in the size of the floods that we get really over the last century or so. We see some areas of decrease and some small areas of increase, but taken as a whole, we don't see a great deal of change.
All right. Well, we're going to take some time to develop that idea further. One of the terms you use, which few of us know, is stationarity. What does it mean, and why is it important for water management or climate?
Right. Stationarity is a statistician's term that has to do with the idea that there's a probability distribution of certain kinds of events, in this case a probability distribution of floods. And the assumption of stationarity is really the assumption that the floods that we get in any given year come from the same distribution that they did in the past, that the mean value, the standard deviation, et cetera, haven't been changing over time. And all of the methodologies that civil engineers and others use to design for things to protect people against flooding, whether it's laying out flood zoning areas, to build flood walls, to design dam spillways, et cetera, are really all based on this assumption of stationarity. And it's very important that we look at the question of, do the data suggest that we're departing from that assumption of stationarity, or are we not at this point?
Right, because if we were departing from it, that might be a signal of climate change. Is that what we're getting?
That's right. But in a lot of cases, it could also be a signal of things that are happening within the watershed, for example, urbanization and land drainage and other things that people do on the landscape. So there's a multitude of possible reasons for non-stationarity, climate change being just one of them.
All right. Well, I've been in correspondence with Dr. Jeff Bonin at the National Atmosphere and Ocean Administration. He, like you, is very cautious about assigning a big role for climate change in the remarkable floods we've seen in the past 3 years or so. I'm thinking of the Mississippi floods in the spring of 2011. It was one of the worst recorded in the past century. Or the strange 2010 flooding of Nashville. Do you think these extreme floods are signs of climate change, or is it something else?
I think any given event can never be demonstrated to be a result of climate change. You have to really look at a preponderance of data and seeing over a large number of locations and over a large period of time that we're seeing a change in this probability distribution of floods. And so a few particularly unusual incidents really don't give a clear demonstration of that. The other thing I would point to is that when we look at very long records, and when I say that, I'm talking about 100 years, 120 years, which are about as long as any of our gauge records go, there are a number of places in the country where we see very long-term variability. And I'll use the upper Mississippi River Basin as an example. It also applies to places like the Red River of the North in North Dakota and in Minnesota. And that is that during the late 19th century, some of these areas had extremely large floods. Then during much of the 20th century, up until the last two or three decades of the 20th century, the floods were much, much smaller by and large. And then they've come back to, we're seeing sort of a clustering of from fairly large events. And when we look at it in that perspective, seeing that we had high and then we had low and then we had high flooding events, it really brings into question the idea that this could be greenhouse driven, because clearly the greenhouse gas increase is a fairly recent phenomenon, mostly in the last 4 or 5 decades. So that it brings up the idea that there are some very long-term, what I call quasi-periodic oscillations in the climate system. People have heard of El Nino and Atlantic Oscillation and some of these things, which are examples of quasi-periodic oscillations causing either wetter conditions or drier conditions or warmer or cooler, and they last for some particular period of time. But I think it's also recognized that some of these kinds of oscillations can last for decades or even centuries. And maybe the classic of all of these oscillations is the ice ages, which came and went over periods of hundreds of thousands of years, obviously with no influence of man causing them to come or go. So I think we have to be kind of recognize that there are some major oscillations that occur that can be driving floods, as well as the possibility that climate change could be driving changes in flooding.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us just a bit more about some of the other human factors that can lead to extreme floods that aren't climate related?
Absolutely. The most well-known and well-understood of these phenomena is in urbanization and the building of streets, sidewalks, rooftops that drain to those streets and sidewalks, and all these things that make much of the land surface relatively impervious, and that the rain that falls on it runs off very, very quickly and creates much larger floods. And this is a phenomenon that's been well known and well documented for many decades and can result in doubling or even quadrupling or even greater increases in the size of floods that one sees in these kinds of watersheds. And in many cases, communities, neighborhoods that say were located along beside a stream that may have been relatively safe from flooding in the past now become very, very susceptible to flooding because of these changes in the drainage system, in the pavement, et cetera, that lies upstream. So this is a very, very big cause of increased flooding. There's another cause which has to do with constraining the river channel between levees or flood walls, which is often used to protect communities in the floodplain. This can have the effect of causing the flood to move more quickly down a river and therefore sort of concentrate itself in areas that are located more downstream. The floodplain of a river, that is to say the flat area typically on both banks of a river, is a very important sort of natural storage device that will naturally attenuate the size of floods. If we don't allow that floodplain to operate and store the water and also allow some of that water to infiltrate into the ground, it can increase the probability of flooding or the size of flooding that occurs downstream. So those are two of the things that are big factors. Other factors that are a little harder to pin down in terms of what their impacts are things like wetland drainage and other forms of drainage like agricultural tile drainage, which have an effect that's somewhat like that of paving over the land surface because it creates a more rapid and direct conduit for the water as it comes down in precipitation to ultimately reach the stream. So this can be another factor, but it's a little harder to identify and estimate how large those consequences are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the award-winning and much-published water expert, Dr. Robert M. Hirsch. He's with the United States Geological Survey. Well, I'm sure, Dr. Hirsch, one of the questions my listeners are asking themselves is, are we seeing more flooding in America than in the past? Can we answer that question?
First of all, I think it's very important that people recognize the distinction between flooding as a sort of a physical phenomena as measured by the amount of water moving down a river versus measuring the damages associated with floods in terms of property losses or even loss of life. Property losses from flooding have definitely gone up in recent decades and seem to be continuing to go up. But a lot of this is associated with more and more people living in harm's way along the floodplains of our nation's rivers. Strictly as a phenomena of how much water comes downstream, we can say a couple of things. If we look at most of the western United States, west of the 100th meridian, which would be a line, a north-south line that would run through about Bismarck, North Dakota, let's say, all the way down to Texas. To the west of that, by and large, we're seeing actually that floods are getting smaller over the last decade. That doesn't mean in every location they are, but in quite a number of them are, particularly in the southwest. And this actually may be related to climate change, and it means because of having smaller snowpacks in the mountains, which in those snowpacks are really a potential source of flooding when they get hit with a warm rainfall event, let's say. Looking more to the eastern part of the United States, there's a couple of areas that seem to be showing some increases. One of them is an area that runs from, let's say, Fargo, North Dakota, on down into parts of Iowa and the upper Midwest that certainly have had a cluster of very large floods in the last, say, since the 1970s and up pretty much to the present. But I should also add that that's an area that saw very large floods in the late 19th century, so it kind of confounds the story. One other area is New England, kind of running from the Catskills outside of New York City and on up through New England, does seem to be showing some increase in the frequency and magnitude of large floods. But for the rest of the eastern part of the country, looking at many stream gauges that we have that have very long records, it's really kind of a random scattershot of some that show increases, some that show decreases, and we would say that it's really nothing more than you would expect by chance alone. So that's kind of the story that we see. We think it's important that it continue to be monitored and continue to be checked because we think it's important to understand if those changes are afoot and to be able to develop an ability to predict how they'll change so people can adjust to the kind of flooding that they may face in the future as climate changes.
Well, should cities be upgrading their stormwater systems or their dikes or other flood defenses?
In general, I think one of the things we've learned in recent years is that there's a lot of uncertainty about the size of floods that one can expect in any given area. And that uncertainty comes because you can go through long periods of relatively small floods and think you don't need to build that infrastructure very large and then encounter a period of large floods. So adding more of a safety factor, I think, can often be important. But I don't think we have the science in hand at this point to tell people what those design changes need to be. I think there are some other reasons to look at urban drainage design, whether it's our rooftops or our lawns or our streets or our sidewalks, and that really has to do with water quality and that the runoff from those areas in through our storm sewers and eventually into our rivers can be a source of considerable pollution. And in areas like resolving problems of Chesapeake Bay's water quality or Lake Champlain or Long Island Sound and a whole variety of places, that changing our design of our urban infrastructure so that it captures more of the water and stores it and really keeps it on the landscape rather than letting it run quickly to the rivers has a lot of merit just because of the things that it will do to help our water quality.
Could you talk to us just a bit more about some of the work that you have done trying to sort out what is unusual weather and what could be climate disruption?
My focus is on the flood phenomena itself as opposed to trying to look at the things that are happening in the atmosphere that create it. I think that's a very important job, to look at what's going on in the atmosphere, but I think it's also important to sort of look at the floods themselves. And we did a little study that we published a couple of years ago, my colleagues and I at the USGS, where we took these very long stream flow records and we asked a very simple question: are the size of the floods that we see at these locations, and there were about 200 of these sites spread all over the country with very long records, and we said, does there seem to be some correlation between the size of the floods and the amount of greenhouse gases in the global atmosphere? And that by looking at the collection of these many sites and the potential relationship, we hoped to be able to see if there was a connection between the two. It's a little bit like medical people doing epidemiological studies. They're not so much focused on what happened to this one person and why did they get sick, but rather to look at an environmental factor. In the case of epidemiology, it might be, say, smoking and the incidence of disease. We're looking at an environmental factor, which is greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and a consequence, which is flooding. And in a general way, we found really no strong association at a national level. And when we looked regionally, the only place we saw a strong association was in the Southwest, where it was a negative relationship. That is to say, the more greenhouse gases, the smaller the floods. So that's what we did. And we have some more studies being planned to look at the data in a variety of other ways to see if we can, the way I like to call it, is see if we can tease out the signal. Because I think ultimately climate change will have some effect, but it's not even entirely clear what that effect might be, what even the direction of the effect might be. And it might be quite different in different parts of the country.
Well, one thing I've noticed about your work, you emphasize the unique properties of each watershed. Do you have a favorite river you like to visit and study?
I have several. I'm fascinated by the Red River of the North, North Dakota and Minnesota, because it's undergone such an enormous change in the flooding phenomena over the last few decades. And there's a lot of competing arguments about why that might be taking place, including the nature of the farming and the fact that the landscape is still rebounding somewhat from the retreat of the glaciers. It's one of the flattest places on the face of the earth, and it's very hard for the water to get out of there. So that's a favorite. Of late, I've been working quite a bit on things in the Susquehanna River, draining large parts of Pennsylvania and some of New York into Chesapeake Bay, and looking at questions of flooding and stream flow in general, and how that relates to the quality of water and the pollution that's going into Chesapeake Bay, and the efforts to try to turn that around. So those are just a couple of favorites that I'm interested in. And the kind of work that I do relies very heavily on very, very long-term, very consistently collected records of stream flow that the USGS has collected now for over 120 years at locations all across the country. And these data are really invaluable at describing environmental conditions all across the country.
Well, when it comes to climate, I wish we had another 100 or 200 years to collect the records, but it looks like things are moving too fast for that. I'm wondering, is there something that I've missed or anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, one of the things, and it's interesting, some people hear my message and come to the conclusion that I'm a climate change denier. And I think it's important to try to be more clear about this particular point of view, and I'm not the only one that holds this particular point of view. I'm not at all a climate change denier. I believe that there's a lot of things that we can see and a lot of things that the climate models seem to be doing a reasonably good job of predicting about changes. And mostly those are about changes in temperature, and particularly about changes in temperature in high latitudes, say near the North Pole or places like Alaska or Northern Canada. But what I'm skeptical about is whether our understanding of the climate system is good enough to understand how these changes in greenhouse gases affect the water cycle and affect particularly how they affect storms. And when I look at the output of the climate models, and how they would describe things that have already happened over, say, the last 100 years, because the models can be run in what we call hindcast mode. In other words, looking at the actual changes in greenhouse gases that have taken place and then simulating what kind of climate changes we might see over the preceding century. The models can do a pretty good job with temperature in general, but they don't seem to do a good job of describing things relating to water. And I don't mean that to just be a put down on the climate scientists. This is a very, very difficult job. And the point I'm trying to make is we probably don't have in hand today in the scientific community the predictive tools to describe what will happen to water as a consequence of climate change, even though we do have tools to describe a number of other things about our environment.
Well, you're not the first scientist to tell me about that uncertainty in the water cycle, and obviously we just need to learn a lot more, and we don't want to spend a lot of money dealing with problems that have to do with other things that humans are doing, as you've brought out, you know, whether it's building in the floodplains and so on. So we want to make sure that we're dealing with the actual changes of climate change, and that's one of the reasons why I called you today. We've been talking with Robert M. Hirsch, a career water expert recommended by other experts. Dr. Hirsch, thank you for spending time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find links for this program at our show blog. That's at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week as Radio EcoShock takes on the world.